I was going to say welcome back, but we haven't been anywhere. Again, it's good to see you. Thanks for joining this evening. As mentioned at the beginning, I'm just going to bring up a Zen koan as a talking point for this evening's Dharma talk. I'm trying to leave some space as well so we can discuss or questions, comment. Koans are good talking points. They usually bring something up. And these Zen koans, as you may well understand at this point, are not meant to just flummox us or be presented as unsolvable riddles, but rather they are admittedly quite ancient, so the language can sometimes, even translated to English, seem a little abstract. These are mostly coming from about 1,200 years ago or something like that. But these people were living human lives just as we were, much more in common than we have than is different between us, human beings. And talking about reality, talking about the wonder and mystery and difficulty sometimes too, right, of this curious mystery that we're all involved in called being human and living this life. And in these koans, then, aspects of this life, perspectives and principles of this life are brought up and discussed, and then presented to us to look at, to see if we can really look under the hood and drill down and look more deeply into this mystery, look more deeply into this experience. Yeah. As those who come to Dharma practice and stick with Dharma practice come to realize, the intellectual mind, the knowing, the dualistic mind, can only reach so far, can only know so much, right? Perhaps quite early on in our experience, we reach the limits, really, of what can be grasped or known. And then there's a shift that takes place in the life of a meditator or a Dharma practitioner, where what is not known and what is non-dual, what is not split, becomes much more the realm in which we can live and express ourselves. That's not that we forget the known and we don't use the intellect, but we use it where appropriate and know the limits of that. So I'm going to bring up a case from the Blue Cliff Record, which is the most celebrated text of the Rinzai Zen school and has been since it was put together in Song Dynasty China, somewhere around in the 12th century, 100 cases that were put together by Secho. He chose the cases from a couple of different collections that were already in existence. One of the transmission of a lamp documents and a record of Umon, who was a teacher in his lineage. Umon's a very famous Zen teacher, and I'm sure you've already heard several koans with Umon in there, and if you haven't, well, you probably will soon, because he figures quite heavily in the book of Equanimity and in the Blue Cliff Record. So Secho put these 100 cases together and then wrote a wonderful verse, an appreciatory verse for each. And these koan collections are quite marvelous, not only for the koans themselves, but the descriptive analogy and the depth of the Chinese poetry to be able to convey subtle meaning and imagery is really exceptional. So without further ado, and after setting it up, this is case 40 from the Blue Cliff Record. So I'll read the intro, the koan, and the verse, because they're all quite short. So the introduction: cease, desist, and an iron tree blossoms. Has this happened to anyone? Has it? A clever person loses their profits. Even if uninhibited, one cannot escape being taken in tow. But tell me, where is the mix-up? And now our case, our example. As the grandee Riku Ko was conversing with Zen teacher Nansen, he said, "Dharma Master Chow said, heaven and earth and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. This is quite marvelous." Nansen pointed to a flower in the garden and said to the grandee, "People today see this flower as if they were dreaming." And then the verse. Perception and cognition are not single units. Mountains and rivers are not viewed in a mirror. When the moon's gone down in the frosty sky, the night half over, with whom will it cast a reflection, cold in a clear pool? All right. So you suspect a wealth of analogy woven into the verse there, and certainly not the only time in koan collections where both the moon and a pool, a moon in water and a reflection in water, is a very celebrated image in Zen Buddhism. Often the moon is symbolizing clear awakening or enlightenment, and when seen in a clear pool, you know, you imagine that clear pool and you see the moon, then that clear reflection, if you look at it in the pool, is that still the moon? Like, what is the nature of reflection? What is something really? Anyway, maybe we'll get to that, but I want to come back to the main case. So this case is known as a Nanto Koan in Zen, which means very difficult to pass through. Very difficult. Like one of the more thornier, difficult to pass through. Not necessarily difficult to pass, though we might be able to find some understanding in, but difficult to pass through, meaning in our life, there's certain koans that you never really get to you never exhaust them. So some questions are with us from all the way through. Difficult to pass through. There's a famous koan about Hyakujo's fox and cause and effect, about the nature of cause and effect and enlightenment. And that's also a difficult to pass through koan. Like, when are we ever free of cause and effect? Nansen was one of the most famous teachers of the Tang Dynasty. It's said that he, like many of these teachers in those days, he was a monk from very early on. Apparently, he was 9 years old when he became a monk, which wasn't uncommon. It was a really good way to get, or one of the only ways to receive an education too, at that time. So, but they join as monks as children and train, and it would be more like a school, and then wouldn't necessarily take on full ordination and live the life of a Buddhist priest. They might leave after when they became adults. But he studied long term and became a Buddhist priest, and was very studied in the sutras, and had an early career of that time until his 40s, apparently. And then for some reason that isn't really talked about, but he had maybe reached the end of that period of time in his life. There wasn't so much to learn in that area. He started to study with a Zen master called Zen Master Basso. And Basso was one of the pivotal Zen teachers of the early era. He studied with Basso, and it's said at that point that he forgot everything he learned about Buddhism at that point, and entered into the direct experience of Zen realization, was not long in Basso's community, but then left and went into the mountains. Like many of the celebrated the Tang Dynasty masters, their teachings survived because they became hermits or went into the deep mountains. And that afforded them some protection from the clash of dynasties, civil wars, political intrigues, and pogroms against Buddhism, all of the politics and the strife and violence that was happening in the more in towns and cities. So he went off into the mountains, and it said that he built himself a small hut and did a solitary practice for 3 years. You know, it's a beautiful thing. People still do that in certain traditions, like the Tibetan tradition has still in the modern era a long tradition of people who go and do a 3-year retreat. Right? I like the idea of building it. Well, I mean, it's easier than it sounds. It like sounds good, doesn't it? Building your own hut in the mountains. I can imagine a show. It's like, you know, sometimes you like stay at a hotel and they put the TV on, and it's always one of those property shows where they're like flipping houses, and you know, and it's just like one shot of somebody knocking a wall out. They always knock a wall out. That always happens. First 15 minutes. Let's open up the space. Knock a wall out. That's like a cliche, right? But then they flip it and it looks amazing. But as you know, if you ever built, did any real building with your own hands, not just a house, but anything really that you had to do with slow, steady care and effort with your own hands, building something like that is no small thing. It must have been difficult. So he built that, and then he stayed there for 3 years in seclusion. And then he was sought out by students. He had a reputation after he left Basso as had a great understanding. And then he was sought out by students, eventually opened a temple and taught people. This is where this takes place. Right, so a grandee, like a grandee or a superintendent, a local dignitary, this comes up in Korn study as well. It's like the local bigwig drops by, you know, the person who's got some sway and some power, and you have to, you know, kind of treat them nicely. You can see, maybe see Nansen's being like, oh gosh, so and so's coming to me. Dang, all right, well, but I have to spend a bit of time with him, you know. So this person comes to see Nansen, and he says, and he brings up this quote. He says, Dharma Master Chow says, heaven and earth and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. That is quite marvelous. So he's bringing a quote, and this is a quote from a teacher from already when this is being brought up. This is extraordinary because he's bringing up a quote which is about 300 or 400 years old already at this point in China, which is pretty, you know, in itself is pretty wild. Seng Chow, who this is talking about, was a Taoist master who kind of converted to Buddhism and Zen. Zen was really hadn't really taken form, but he was a famous Taoist teacher, and was an early Zen teacher. And he had this phrase which became famous in early Zen: heaven and earth and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. This is quite marvelous. So this person who comes to see Nansen's really impressed with this quote. I don't know if you ever, I think we all do, right? We pick up quotes. Like, quotes can be really inspirational, useful. Sometimes things, you know, you read something beautiful. Like at the beginning, I often bring up that one. Wendell Berry is a poet and writer and farmer and environmentalist. He has a quote that was, the earth is something we all have in common. You know, it's quite simple. Right. But I was brought that in at the beginning, that like at some point that really struck me, just that simple line, like we all have that in common. That's true. Right. And so we we can pick up quotes and they can be very inspirational, but there's a real difference between hearing something cool, noteworthy, or something really good and smart from a teacher or a leader or somebody. There's a difference between hearing that quote and sharing it and actually having the experience that is being talked about. Right? In our quote, heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. This is quite a simple quote in some sense too. It's like heaven, all things, heaven and earth, you know, the Milky Way, the cosmos, everything has the same root. That doesn't sound such like an outlandish thing to say. You know, maybe we'd all agree with that. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, everything has the same root. But does it? And how do we know that? Like, how can we personally attest to that? Or is it something we might, sounds good, or we might kind of take it for granted? Myriad things and I are one body. Right? Clearly talking about non-separation and unity. But, you know, what the Buddha talked about, I, all beings, the great earth, are the awakened one to thusness. I, all beings, simultaneously attain the way. Many teachers, both living and dead, have talked about this very point. And as a quote, it's fine. But the essential thing in our meditation and in our Dharma practice is to realize this for ourselves. So again, just talking about like our basic instruction for sitting is also it's basic, but it's fundamental. That's like all of the Dharma there. When we're saying, sit down, come into contact with things, you know, don't worry, don't chase thoughts around. Let go of clinging to thinking about this and that. You know, feel the body as it is. Listen to the sound and the silence. Right, open the aperture of awareness to let awareness fill your experience, and then receive the world as it is, and drop the part that is contrasting, comparing, critiquing, maneuvering. Right, that's that essential shift. Master Cho said, myriad things and I are one body. If we're meeting or allowing myriad things to come forward and experience us, and we don't have any complaint or ranking of what we prefer in that experience, then we can deeply realize the truth of this, I and all things are one body. Dogen, many centuries later, he talks about enlightenment or awakening, and he says, to carry the self forward and experience things is upside down. But, and yet, that is the default way that human beings live. That's how we are. We all do that. I carry me forward and experience things and other people. That's like the preloaded software that we're running, right? It's like self and other are distinct in the human experience. We have no problem in believing in that separation because we are wired as an evolutionary imperative to create separation in our experience, as the kind of the sort of barely involved primates that we are, right? But we know, we clearly see, we look into the world and we see, oh my God, the world is on fire and look how much suffering there is. I was talking about this era in China where there were wars, there was strife, there was all kinds of things. What's changed 2,000 years later? this is the human condition, creating self and other. Right? In order to relieve ourselves of that belief in self and other, it is necessary to deeply experience and realize no self, no other. But in the laboratory of our lived experience, right, which is what meditation and Zazen and presence is, it's like just be vos as we are, and then allow those divisions, those ways that we separate, the ways that we compare and contrast, and we can allow those to soften and even dissolve. All of those ways of splitting up the world are going on, just created between our ears. The problem is, that's true for everyone else on the planet. So, like, we're all creating that self and other. You know, but the way of the Dharma, of the deep inquiry into Dharma, is to truly realize that though there is the appearance of self and other, at the root, there is no self and other. And at the root, we are all one body. And awareness is the root experience of all. It is that's here now, every one of us showing up a little differently, looking a little differently, different stories, different history, different personality. And yet, when we see each other here and hear each other here, where do we meet? And how can we communicate? How is it that we see each other, hear each other, experience one another? This is all taking place because we share the same root, the same awareness, the same life that is unfolding and expressing each one of us. And whether the grandee, you know, sees this or not, or to whatever degree he sees this, maybe he just picks it up as a quote, and it's a throwaway comment. Isn't this a wonderful quote? You know, it's like if you like scroll through like Facebook or something, and it's like, you know, three or four quotes, like inspirational, they're really good, but you kind of read them and then you just forget them, like right after. Maybe it's shallow like that. I think probably deeper. He says, how marvelous. How marvelous. Who knows what is genuine insight, is penetration of what that statement is. But Nansen receives this comment in an interesting way. He just points that they're walking, apparently. And he points. And in the tradition, it says it's a peony. They name the kind of flower that it is. In this translation, it just says a flower. So he just points at a flower and says, people these days see this flower as if they were dreaming. Now, how would we take that if we were this visiting person? I mean, it's interesting, Nansen, he doesn't say you. He doesn't say, hey, when you look at this flower, you're in a dream. He says people, you know, just speaking generally, but of people these days, when they see this flower, it's as if they're dreaming. Like, what is our experience of a flower? I hope you're fortunate to see flowers every day. All right, flowers are just one of the most extraordinary things on this earth, right? I remember listening to a talk from Eckhart Tolle years and years ago, and he said, at one point on the earth, there was a time where the first flower in creation bloomed, which is true, right? There had to be one that was like the first one. The first flower opened. There wasn't a human around to see it, right? Apparently, at one point in the early formation of the earth, the entire landmass of the planet was covered in ferns. It was just ferns. Right? You have to check me on that if you look it up. I read it somewhere. Right? For millions of years, isn't it extraordinary? There were not even any people. It's just the world getting on, being the world. All kinds of, like, for just incalculable, like, you know, sometimes you'll read, well, for a million years, And you kind of skip past like, oh, a million years, okay. It's like, no, hold on. What's a million years? It's an unimaginable length of time is what it is, right? A million years, 10 million years. And for all of these, like a million years or however long, flowers that have bloomed all over the earth. So how is it when we out and about in our day, going about our business with our busy minds, and you know, I'm that way, like with my errand list, I've got my to-do list, got to pick this up, got to go over there, got to make sure I'm back by 2 o'clock. You know, this is like how we are as human beings, and you walk past, like here where I live now, there's a lot of citrus trees, which is amazing to me, because at Yokoji, it's like, you know, you can grow acorns. That's about it. But down here, it's like there's citrus trees, and often they don't even get picked, right? It's just like laden with like lemons and oranges. And I'm walking around thinking, can I just take those? Can I just get a few of these and take them home? Sometimes I do that. And then flowers, when we see flowers around us, how do we experience that? Do we just walk right on by? Do we take a moment and notice and think, how beautiful? Do we take a longer time and to sit and to really appreciate that? You know, and this isn't a pitch to do that. You know, sometimes in Dharma or we'll talk, it'll be like, yeah, we should take some time, slow down, sit, consider a flower, look at something beautiful like that. That's a very rich practice. But whether we see a flower for a short time and a long time, do we really see it? Do we let it really see us? You know, do we remember, like Dogen's line, if we're carrying ourselves forward experiencing things, it's always upside down. It's always me in a world of separate things. But allowing the 10,000 things to come forward and experience this one, to experience the self, that's awakening, that's enlightenment. To receive the world, to receive the flower, to receive the sky, right? Not as something separate, but letting it really penetrate your bones, to really let the world in. So often, you know, we create this kind of shell, a shell of the self, me, I. Feels like it ends here at the fingers and at the toes. But if we look deeply, we see that this self is extended in all directions all the time. That there's no edge, there's no limit, and there's no gap. And what is it that we're calling the self? Each one of us is a whole world and experiencing and receiving the whole world. Appearing as the whole world. In the verse, perception and cognition are not singular units. Seeing something and then working it out. Right? It can feel like that. Like there's steps involved. See something. Make the appraisal. Decide whether it's wanted or not. Right? Everything washing coming through the filter. Mountains or rivers are not viewed in a mirror. So when we see, like we're lucky here in the desert to have for those of us that are down here, but I look around and several people who aren't living in Palm Desert do have mountains outside their windows too, right? When you see them, are you seeing the reflection? Or are we really allowing them to see us? Is that one thing or two things? If it's always me looking out at something, then it's always, there can be a little extra step there. That's something to really look at. This is like, do you see the flower in a dream or do you really see the flower? It's curious that word, you know, bringing it up in dream. I just feel like waking life, you know, I feel like I dream at night. I'm a big time dreamer. And I always sort of typically remember my dreams too. And when I'm in a dream, that's real. right? It's like sometimes you take like dreams aren't real. Well, when you're, well, I'm in a dream, that's reality. You know, completely reality. And then when dreaming falls off and the hours disappear and you just fade into a kind of an oblivion, which is no inconvenience whatsoever. In fact, it's quite wonderful and renewing, right? That's completely reality. No problem. And then we wake in the morning and, you know, into another dream. It's like that movie Inception, you know? It's just like, am I still dreaming? Sometimes I feel that way. It's just like, this is like, it's still dreaming. It's just like a different layer. But it's like, however it is, whether you call it dream or not, this is our life. This is our reality. And as practitioners, as people who sit, meditate, and inquire into Dharma, we're always somewhere involved in that shift, right? We understand that to live in a me, I centric, bolted down, walled off world is no fun. That's like where the dukkha is. That's where the extra, right? That's where the trouble lies. That one, not to like throw that one away or cast that one aside, but to open up from that position, you know, to be able to say, yeah, this whole world, this world belongs to me, but only as much as it belongs to you and belongs to everybody else too. And that we can broaden our connection and reach further, and always being cautious of that default pattern that we have as humans, where just in the blink of an eye, we can chop the world into two. We can create right and wrong. We can create self and other, good and bad, and all of the 10,000, 100,000 ways that we create these dualities. No problem with dualities, so long as you have access to non-duality. Then you can live in both, or even better, live in neither.